how what's going on here is a demonstration that everything is empty of inherent existence by the very fact of dependent arising, and that things are not empty of inherent existence because they're here functioning, but because they all arise and exist dependent on causes and conditions. And we're trying to bring this closer to ourselves. We use the eye as an example. And we've also seen how this kind of operates not only with physical things, but with appearances, with social things, with all kinds of things. So it's good to keep coming at it from those different angles. And there was rather a good one in here that I read from Rob Berbia earlier in the week. And this one's rather good. He's taken it from Geoffrey Hopkins, but he's done it in a really good way. And he's acknowledged Geoffrey in the book. And that's, he looks at it from, this is taking that same kind of thinking to look at countries. So he says, it's quite easy to see that countries, for instance, do not have the kind of inherent existence that we as a species seem so readily to believe and feel they have. A country only exists because of human agreement. It's a human convention. Even just a few hundred years ago, which from the perspective of the geologists' timescales of the Earth is extremely recent, there was no United States of America, no Germany. Just like others, the concepts of these countries were at some point concocted by humans from various other notions. Sometimes, for example, the solidification of a notion of ethnicity is bound up in the concept of a country, often in an unhelpful way. Whether or not that is the case, though, the establishment of any country is then dependent on enough people consistently seeing it in a certain way. Without the belief in the notion of a USA, would an entity called the USA have any reality? Other than as an idea, is there any reality to the claim that a certain patch of sand and rock is in the USA rather than in Mexico? Imagining even a short time into the future, we can see that if the agreements and notions on which it depends do not persist widely or strongly enough, any currently existing country may simply cease to exist. New agreements might form new countries, and what seems real now will, for most, lose its sense of reality. Of course, a group of people in one area coming together and deciding to create a framework to support their collective well-being is not in itself a problem. It will probably be helpful, in fact. But when the patently fabricated nature of countries is not recognised, the concept of this country or my country can gain an overwhelming force and solidity in human minds. The belief in the country as something real can give rise to a strength and rigidity of feeling beyond even the biological impulse for survival. How much violence and suffering in human history has there been with roots in this reification? How much willingness to kill and die dependent on such a belief? The relatively obvious insights proffered above also make clear that there's no a priori reason why a country's boundaries need to be positioned where they currently are. These lines have to be an agreed, or an agreement on them forced, with humans in other countries. Extending this a little, however, we can see that regardless of where exactly the borders are at present drawn, the very notion of any particular country exists in relation to the notion of what is not this country. Usually this means other countries, England, only has a meaning with respect to and in differentiation from what is not England, Ireland, Scotland, Wales or France, for instance. Any concept of this country thus arises together with and dependent on a concept of those countries. Though it might seem to, no country exists independently of other countries. None has inherent existence. The point of this discussion is not to say that we shouldn't have countries, or that we should, but that we can be aware that they are human fabrications. It's important for us to be able to see them as such, to realise their emptiness at this simple level, partly as a very basic exercise, and partly because if we do not, suffering is likely somehow to ensue. And that also the point he makes about the relationship between this country and then other country, I think goes back to something that's very kind of fundamental in human behaviour, but not innate or permanent in any way, but it's acquired at a very early age. You know, you might, to assert something about oneself is very often to other people, you know. So within any given community, I suppose the easiest one to pick is the Buddhist community, isn't it, because we're here in a Buddhist community. But then it's very easy to me or any of us almost innocently say, oh, but if you're a serious Buddhist, serious Buddhists do this, you're immediately othering everybody else who you don't consider to be a serious Buddhist. But we do it without thinking. We even think it's a legitimate thing to do. We need to don't stop for a moment. So we're creating a fabrication on the basis of which we're going to make judgments that might be upsetting to many, sort of consoling to some. And you create an in-group of, oh yes, I'll talk to that person because they're a serious Buddhist. And these other people, no, I'm not going to talk to them because they're not serious Buddhists, you know. And then those divisions appear and all of this. This is all dependent on causes and conditions, largely conceptual. Yet it impacts behaviour, the way we see ourselves, the way we see others, and the way we see the world, you know. So when anybody says, if anywhere, you know, if somebody sort of says, oh, well, serious artists or serious bus drivers or whatever it is, I'm thinking, who are they outing? Who are they othering? Yeah, what's going on there? Yeah. And then it's the assumption that, of course, the serious ones are inherently serious, and the other ones are inherently not serious, and there's no possibility of movement or change, and off we go. You know, so it's a way of getting this more abstract stuff, thinking about it, and it crosses, you know, when in the Buddhist word phenomena, meaning all things, it means all things, whether they're physical. You know, we were looking at the very kind of physical world and all of that, but it applies to what we might call the social world, the conceptual world, the intellectual world, the psychological world. Yeah, it applies at every level. Of course, each level has certain differences in terms of its types of stuff, but of course they're all interrelated. The mind, body of individuals, consciousness, the universe, they don't exist separately in vacuums. They're, again, kind of inseparable. So he had one... I'll save that one. Or not, because countries was really good. No, I'll leave it there for now, because it's a lot of reading. I can do another one another time. That's rather good. So anyway, thus far from where we got yesterday to now, any questions, or is it simple, is it clear, is it okay, or any discussion you want? Happy to open it up a bit. The Seeing That Frees from Rob Verbier again. But so this particular idea he took from Geoffrey Hopkins. Mm. Geoffrey Hopkins has it in a book called Emptiness Yoga.
Okay.
It's a part of his introduction to Emptiness Yoga. Some fascinating ones there. I mean, there was a kind of a... again, you see, it's the notion that, oh, it starts from good intentions. in saying you want to keep the language on the straight and narrow so that everybody can understand it and it's intelligible and there are shared meanings and all of this. But then it becomes a search for an inherently existing English language, which just doesn't exist. It's a fantasy. Any language is a living thing. If we look up the definition of a term in a dictionary, dictionaries are really, really useful. It's really good to look at definitions. But really, without doing away with that or denigrating it in any way, if you actually want to know the meaning of a word, listen to how a person uses it. Because meaning changes over time, over cultures, between communities. The reference may not change an awful lot, but the connotations may, to a great degree. So the sense changes even if the reference doesn't change. And dictionaries have to catch up, don't they? I'd look pretty silly if I was trying to teach children English with an 18th century dictionary. Mm-hmm. And as someone who did a bit of that in his time, trying to teach them the way Chaucer spoke is another language. Like it or not, you know, it's kind of... It's like that. Somehow the idea that there was something more than a language made up by its parts, and most importantly, a dynamic community of speakers, led to the idea that there was an inherently existing English, and no doubt every other language. And then Oxford and the BBC had a war about who had the monopoly on it. Was it Oxford English or BBC English? It was never the Queen's English in that sense. That was an entirely poetic term. Mm-hmm. And then you look the other way, you look across, thinking back to countries. If you look across to Virginia and the East Coast, you know, those just around there on the East Coast of America, we say, oh, that's, you know, look what the Americans have done to the language. In actual fact, if we're going to say that something in the past was more authentic, that's almost perfect 16th, 17th century English. They preserved it better than anyone else. So...
Isn't it similar when countries...
You can seg again right back into the self, because this is very... You know, it depends on who you are, where you're brought up, what time and all the rest of it. But for some people, that national identity, which is already not an inherently existing thing, but an agreement, becomes a strong part of their own identity. Yeah? It's really very... kind of weird. We take it in, it becomes part of our identity, and as he rightly says, you know, rightly or wrongly, depending on your political views, people are then prepared to die for it. I could, looking at it from the point of view of, you know, partly kind of language, and partly kind of you see the way people concretize something, you know, create an inherent existence that isn't really there. I was always bemused by the whole way football went, because I grew up and saw it at a certain time, and I thought, someone's forgotten something here, and that's what it was supposed to be, a game, wasn't it? It didn't say you have to take it so seriously that you'd not talk to your neighbour or punch them, or, you know. And if it ceases to, if it gets that serious, it's no longer a game, is it? Then that... Was I attached to the inherently existent idea of a game? Here, see how these things are relative. It's fascinating. But yes, how national identity and other things impact on our own identity, it's another cause and condition, isn't it? I'm a certain way because there are elements that my development, character, persona, whatever it is, depends upon. And I'm very happy to say in this case it doesn't, but it could be a strong sense of nationality. Yeah, I'm almost one of those.
Exhausting.
Yeah. But anyway, this is again the fascination of dependent arising and how we exaggerate the way things appear and then solidify around them and take these other things which are really kind of not in any way us and make them a part of our identity. And then just assume it inherently exists that way, and that's the way I was done, that's the way I'm made, kind of thing. Yeah. Well, there was I forget his name, but there was one Liverpool football manager, wasn't there, that was very famous, where somebody said, you know, the way you carry on with football, it's like a religion. He said, no, it's more serious than that. And I had the misfortune to have to go up to Liverpool shortly after the Hillsborough disaster, because I was attendant to the man who was conducting the inquiry, and I really got the feel of it. The whole city was in mourning, and this is all football. I know people have died and all that, but I'd not before got a sense of how serious and how solid that all was. How tragic, absolutely tragic. Immense amount of suffering, all bound up around ideas, exaggerations.
I have a friend.
We can all get a bit like that over things like New Year's Eve, New Year's Day. Well, it's the Gregorian calendar. It wasn't that long ago. It moved from another one. If we go to any other culture, there's a different character. I think it's about 2060 something in Tibet Buddhist calendar, depending which of the five you want to use, and so on. These are just conventionalities, but then they get very, very solidified and over-reified in people's minds, and then suddenly New Year's is very important. And, oh yeah, that's... Yeah, okay, we use it as an opportunity to reflect on the past year and think about the new one. We use it as an opportunity in bleak winter to have a celebration. Fine, but then suddenly it all gets very... And it is, it's really... And I'm sure there are some people around that, if you said, actually, calendars move, calendars change, you could have another one. How could you do that? Well, you could add extra days the same way that we do. We've only got one extra day with a leap year once every 4 years. Tibetans have got about three a month extra calendrical days, or calendrical days get taken out to make the calendar work. And people think, well, how can you do that? Because you can't take days out. No, it's nothing to do with days. It's just convention, you know. But that suddenly the conventions, when they sit there long enough, appear to exist inherently. In a way, they were literally, you know, where they were up on the Himalayan plateau. They kind of, because of people coming and going, although not that many people, they kind of knew what gold was all about. But for them, it wasn't as valuable as other things. Mm-hmm. It's a valuable metal kind of thing, but they had more value for lapis lazuli and turquoise and things like that. So, and when they traded, these things were worth more money. So lots of them, when the Chinese were driving them out of Tibet, left the gold behind because they didn't see it as very valuable. It's relative. There's another very good passage in here, if anyone wants to borrow it and read it, which is on the perceived inherent existence of worth and value, rather than seeing its relativity. And at the same time, people say, oh, well, you can't say we don't... No, no, it's not a criticism of the thing itself any more than this is a criticism of having countries. They can really be quite useful. It seemed, but when, as soon as we over-exaggerate the way in which they exist or their significance, it becomes problematic. Yeah, that's the one. I mean, we could have decided on anything. Yeah, it's a similar question to saying, well... Is what the Buddha's talking about the end of desire? And the answer's no, of course. What it is, it's the end of desires which have no basis, generated and driven by appearances not existing in the way that we think they do.
Do you mean delusions?
Take an example. Remember we were talking about Lama Yeshe and the chocolate cake. There's nothing wrong with the taste of the chocolate cake. In fact, it's really, really beautiful. Just the phenomenology of the taste, if you like chocolate cake. Yeah, I'm not a chocolate cake fancier, but if you are, I can think of the things that I really like. Taste is really, really beautiful, and there's nothing good or bad in that, and there's no problem with it. And even indeed, if the pleasure, you know, brings about like, there's no problem with that. But if that turns into an attachment to, I must have it, I can't live without it, and I want to eat the whole cake, and I want another one, and I'm going to change my behaviour. Well, in order to control desires which we perceive as harmful for ourselves, and to stop them going out of control, then either withdrawing from them or setting boundaries can be a good idea.
I'm talking about why I'm doing it.
It would be to, you recognise it, yeah? You recognise that. So just rest in the stillness. Acknowledge this one going on. Of course it's going on. You know, there it is.
Yeah.
And indeed, you can also reflect that it's that drive or desire that's actually the yearning for enlightenment, for liberation.
Again?
That drive is the desire for enlightenment, for liberation. I mean, there's a distinction here between wholesome and unwholesome desires, but it's not written down in a book saying these are wholesome and these are unwholesome, this is moral, this is not moral. Mm. It's saying, what's it relative to? It's relative to the desire for liberation and enlightenment. So if you want that, then to deploy or take desire into the path to make liberation and enlightenment possible is kind of a wholesome thing. But you need to, you're aware of it, if you see what I mean. You're aware of what it's doing. And then if the desire is, if you, the odd thing here is if the whatever stage you're talking about, but if you think you really wanted that state of stillness, that felt like you to be some realization of rest and stillness. If this is doing this with it, it's gonna grab hold of it, try to freeze it, and then there'll be unhappiness when it goes, which it will.
Mm.
Yeah. But if you can let all that rah 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 go on, it'll fade away, and you'll have a state of stillness until the state of stillness goes. And then it'll cut. There'll be another one until it goes, like that. Well, I suppose the first point to raise, if the question is a good one to keep, mm-hmm. good one to keep as an open question. But do we think you're doing yourself any harm by indulging in stillness?
if you're doing.
Yeah, making sessions and so on and so forth. Fine, but what if you sold your house, gave everything up, cleared off, sat in a cave, did it for life, never laid up for food, and then died of starvation? Would that be a good idea? We'd say that's exaggerated, wouldn't we? Yeah, someone could say, actually, I do want to go and do that for life, but they make proper plans to do it. It's a different kind of thing. Is it an obsession?
Mm.
Is it out of control? Mm. Or I think sometimes we kind of depart from common sense on it a bit. Mm. I don't know, maybe we carry it over. Maybe there is some of it in institutionalised Buddhism, I don't know. Or maybe we carry it over from Christianity. But this idea that, you know, enjoyment or pleasure is somehow wrong. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not what the Buddha's teaching. He's teaching we all want pleasure and we don't want pain.
Mm.
And one of the problems is because we think things exist in a way that they don't, the things that we immediately think are pleasurable turn out not to be. Yeah. So where is lasting pleasure in that sense? Yeah. So it's not this idea of here I am, I've been meditating with the intention to reach a certain state of stillness. You know, I recognise this as being like it's what I was trying to do has kind of happened. Yeah, and then when something pops up and says, "This might be indulgent," you know, "This might be might not be right in some way," then I'd question that one. Maybe that's just more noise. Maybe that's something from the past. Maybe that's something from childhood. Maybe that's something I got from teachers, maybe. But if you're in the state where you want to be, you've got the luxury of just resting there and seeing what these clouds do. But you don't have to react to them. Maybe they just disappear. Maybe they just come up like that, and you'll think, Why am I being indulgent? Maybe, maybe not. Oh. If it becomes a big issue, then maybe you just think, yeah.
Okay. So would you say that?
But, yeah, think a bit, not to tighten up too much around it, but open up with it, yeah? And yeah, let it be there. Don't try and deny it. But it's interesting that it pops up, no? Mm. And certainly, if you look at all the instructions from really, really good meditators, they'll say, you know, one of the problems is that when you do start to have some realizations, we want to hold on to them. But the fact of the matter is, you can't freeze them. As soon as you try to freeze them, they're gone. Yeah. That then, so you have to kind of open up, give it space, and things come, abide for a while, and go. Come, abide for a while, and go. And not to grasp onto them in that way. But in there, and I still go there frequently, you know, so I can recognise that one. It's like, oh, yeah. You know, I think, oh, that's interesting, that one. So it's, yeah, of course, there's the pleasure will arise as a result for all sorts of reasons. Yeah. Nothing wrong with that. No, the problematic attachments and aversions are the ones that are based on a perception of things existing in the way they appear when they don't. Suffering then guaranteed. But it's not about an end of desire or an end of, you know, engaging with life, or cessation is not about. Otherwise, you know, if this was the right interpretation of Buddhism, we might just all commit suicide right now. We'd do the world a favour and ourselves. And that's not what the Buddha's teaching.
Isn't
right understanding or right view, yes, right thought, yeah, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, and right concentration. Intention would be covered with thought. It's, okay. It's between thought and view, but more with the thought, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, part of right understanding is right where we are. We're contributing to right understanding by trying to think about what, go right back to the Four Noble Truths and the Second Noble Truth, the origin of suffering. So the origin of suffering is this. What exactly is it? Oh, well, it's greed, hatred and ignorance, but the other two rest on ignorance. What's ignorance? What do they mean by ignorance here? They mean, sorry to say it again, we are beguiled into thinking that things exist in the way they appear. So the more deeper, more profound, the more experiential your understanding becomes of that, the better your view, and the more sure and more confident you are in it. I think one of the problems for us is that we hear the words, we read the words, we think we've got it, but we don't really have a conviction about it. So we're always thinking, am I doing the right thing? Have I really got the right view? Is it because we don't have the conviction? And that really only comes from doing what we're doing. Comes from practicing, comes from talking, comes from reading, comes from thinking about it. And also, you know, don't forget, I know it's hard, particularly on the boredom front, but the Tibetan word for meditation, gom, means familiarization, literally, which means doing it again and again and again and again, to keep coming at it, you know, in the same way, in different ways, regularly. Because there's sort of shed loads of habit, years and years and years of habit, conditioning, that the inertia against doing what we want to do is quite strong. So we know that the only way you can deal with those sorts of heavy conditioning is to chip away at it, but also keep trying to have insights into it, because there are certain perspectives that might just dissolve it completely. And it's a long game in a way. There's always the possibility it might happen in the next moment or tomorrow, but it, by and large, realistically, that's why we continue to practice, and probably why most of us think it's worth continuing to practice. Because we have moments that make us think, it actually works. Yeah. I mean, it's exactly the same as when you were Was there ever a time where you suddenly said, I want to be an artist? But then how long from then to actually doing what you want? I mean, if I, or if I, you know, I'm not, but if I was a violinist and I said when I was seven, I had a violin when I was seven, I want to be a violinist. I'm not going to be a violinist in much short of 10 or 12 years unless I'm an absolute prodigy, which is really quite rare. Yeah. It's anything worth doing usually involves time, practice, application, going the wrong way, getting lost, coming back, reaffirming one's intention, motivation. But on this particular one, on the right understanding, I think what you're doing now and what we're all doing now is part and parcel of trying to get more conviction, which then makes it easier and gives you more certainty when certain things happen and occur, that, oh yes, it's okay. There's, the doubt goes, the doubt kind of eases back a bit. Does that make sense? I mean, then doubt, see, doubt's not a problem on its own. That's very healthy in some cases. Like, actually, if you want to gain conviction about this, then it's very good to say, okay, there might be sort of, you know, very wise and Indian and Tibetan philosophers from a long tradition, you know, and all the rest of it. But are they right? A healthy scepticism and doubt will aid greater conviction in the beginning. Sort of nagging an irrational doubt based on, you know, lack of confidence or lack of conviction or not really having done the work, that's, then it becomes problematic. But there's nothing inherently good or bad about doubt. It's relative to what form and so on and so forth. So you know, to have a healthy scepticism or a healthy doubt can be fine in some areas, and in other areas, as you find, it can be very undermining, because you're just like, oh, I'm not sure about this, not sure about that. Is that helpful or not?
Just a try.
Just a try. Okay. Anyway, I think the bell will go off in a minute, but if someone's got one more, I can do it. We can pick it up if I can't finish. Okay, it's lunchtime then. Bell or no bell?